Good evening and welcome. Many years ago, I started reading Poetry Magazine again, a magazine that I had stopped reading because I was so unhappy with the confessional and introspective and what I thought, certainly by my own views, and kind of uninteresting poetry that was being published. I then read an article about a new editor, Christian Wyman, and I picked up poetry again and discovered many voices, some established, some new, and one in particular blew me away. And I would tell people about A.E. Stallings, and they would just look at me blankly, mainly because those people tended not to be people who were reading poetry. And I asked all those people to start reading Poetry Magazine. And I followed A.E. Stallings and others, to be sure, for some time. Then my connection to Poetry Magazine was cemented a little more. I did a translation for one of the issues, and I ended up being published in the same issue as A.E. Stallings, who had also translated something. And I started doing something at Cornell called the Dr. T Project, and decided that, in which I cover important items of cultural interest, and I decided that A.E. Stallings was an important item of cultural interest. And so I spoke about her for a few minutes to some students, and then we made a t-shirt. And so on the back of the t-shirt, I had to put some of the items I'd covered, and I put A.E. Stallings' name. I then mentioned this to Gail Holst-Warhaft, who's a dear friend and colleague, and she said, well, I know A.E. Stallings. In fact, I'm going to Greece. I'll take the t-shirt. And so the t-shirt went to Greece, and a volume of one of A.E. Stallings' poetry came back, Hapax or Hapax, and she didn't know, I think, the poet, that I'm actually someone who works on Hapaxes in the Quran. At any rate, this is the introduction to how it occurred to me, and then with the close collaboration of Gail Holst-Warhaft, it occurred to us to nominate A.E. Stallings for a Messenger lectureship. In this enterprise, we received the co-sponsorship and collaboration of the Society for the Humanities, the Department of English, the Department of Classics, the Department of Comparative Literature, and through the persons of Gail and myself, the Mediterranean Studies Initiative and the Department of Near Eastern Studies, which incidentally is the greatest department of Near Eastern Studies in the world. The Messenger Lectures were established in 1924 through a bequest by a graduate of Cornell who had graduated, I believe, in 1880, to bring in people that Cornellians and people in Ithaca would not otherwise hear. In writing the nomination, I had some hesitation because I worried that a poet would not be, the nomination would not go through for a poet. Certainly no other poet had ever been nominated, or if they had been, they certainly hadn't received the approval. So we were delighted when the Messenger Lecturer, that is to say the University Lectures Committee, agreed. She was supposed to come in April, and this was delayed to October for all kinds of reasons, but we think there were good reasons, and this is why we're here today. So I'd like to thank the university for its intelligence in accepting the nomination. I'd like to thank A.E. Stallings and her husband, John Seropoulos, who's sitting right next to her, and their young children, who are in the hotel, in the Statler, for hauling all the way out here from Athens, Greece. Did I mention that they live in Athens, Greece? And I'd like to thank you all for coming. I think we're in for a real treat. Three lectures, one today, one Wednesday, in this room at this time, on translation of poetry, another thing which she's accomplished. And then something at the museum, the Johnson Museum, on Thursday at 7, which will be a reading by A.E. Stallings, and which will then morph into a poetry night, an elegant soiree of poetry and pastry to which you are all invited. I'm going to leave it to my friend Gail Holst-Warhaft to do the remaining introduction. Thank you again, and hold your applause, not that I need any.
I've been reminded to tell you to turn your cell phones off. It seems to be the way every evening starts these days, with a statement about cell phones. But since I've forgotten to turn my own off, it was a salutary reminder. Thank you, Shokot. Shokot is the person, I think, with about the best ideas on this campus, which is why I like doing things with him, because he keeps coming up with yet another wonderful idea, and so far this is the best idea of all. I'm delighted that Alicia and John have come here to Ithaca. It it seems appropriate. It is Ithaca, after all, and there is a strong Greek connection. And I also want to say, for those people who are not only interested in poetry, that John will be talking at 4 o'clock in the physics building, the physical sciences building, room 401, on Thursday before Alicia speaks, and he'll be talking about the Greek crisis, a fairly hot topic at the moment. Just a couple of words. I said that I would say a couple of words, and they are a couple of words about Alicia. And a friend of mine today to whom I spoke, who's a great admirer, said, "Oh, you're not. Just read a poem." he said, "Don't say a word. Just read a poem. That'll do." And so I just wanted to say that, you know, I have a few, as a person who is a poet myself, I always have a few books of modern poetry on my shelf above where I write. And, you know, sometimes you look at them to see how you're measuring up with, or to steal a little trick from one of them. And other times you you look at them for just the unadulterated pleasure of rereading them. And then there are ones you love to read because they seem to be speaking both to you and for you. And the poetry books on my desk come from an odd mixture of languages and cultures, and surprisingly few in English, but Kavafi is a keeper. He's always there. And I can never put away Yehuda Amichai's latest book of poems, Open, Closed, Open. If you haven't read it, run out and buy it. Szymborska's complete poems are always there. And Heaney's Human Chain, and Stalling's Hapax, to which I have now added Olive's, her most recent book. And why? Why is she in this group of poets? Well, there are firstly the personal things that Stallings writes of so many things that I love. She writes of Greece, Greek mythology, mourning and grief, children, animals, and two of the poems I like best of hers are about animals, and the subjects, rather oddly, are species that D.H. Lawrence, who I think must be perhaps the finest of English poets writing about animals, he made his snake and his bat so memorable that I thought nobody could write about those again. But Stalling's poem Momentary is a wonderful poem, I think, recently published in Poetry, and it's one of regret for an unrealized encounter, as is Lawrence's. But where Lawrence's snake is a lordly male, the glamorous creature glimpsed in Stalling's garden is a charming, elusive female. And I quote, "Too late, I notice as she passes, zither of chromatic scale, I only ever see her tail, quicksilver into tall grasses. I only know her by her flowing, by her glamour disappearing into shadow as I'm nearing. I only recognize her going." How lovely that quicksilver is as a verb, and how that word glamorous conjures up some slightly old-fashioned beauty, a star of the silent screen in a shimmering lamé dress. So I've always loved what she does with things that you think, gosh, can she really take on that ancient, modern Greek stuff that is has been done by other people, and she does it, and she does it so wonderfully. But apart from their settings and their subjects, Stalling's poems have two qualities that make her indispensable to me. One is this formal grace she has, a technical brilliance that appears to be totally effortless, and the other is her sense of humor. And I just want to read one very funny little poem that had me laughing so much that I couldn't stop. Stoic Seneca wasn't a hero to take on a pupil like Nero, but I tell you, in those days, it took some cojones to give his assignments a zero. And with that, I would like to introduce Joni Mikowski from the English department, who will say perhaps a few more words about somebody that's difficult to say enough good about. Thank you.
Funny tripartite introduction, but okay, this is it takes three of us to do this properly. I'm delighted and honored to introduce A.E. Stallings. And to begin, I'd like to go back in time, not to ancient Greek pre-antiquity, not to a prelapsarian poetic era when minutes actually were trochees. Rather, let's go back to the 1990s. That's when poems by A.E. Stallings first started appearing in journals and anthologies. Her poems first appeared in Poetry magazine in 1995. In 1994, her poem, Apollo Takes Charge of His Muses, was included in the annual anthology Best American Poetry. And that edition was edited by A.R. Ammons, of all people. And it's fascinating to look at that 1994 table of contents, because who but Archie Ammons would have included poems by Richard Wilbur, James Merrill, Sharon Olds, Dean Young, and Lynn Hajanian. You know, that's, you know, some lineup, among others, among A.E. Stallings. So, but back in the 1990s, there was a lot of discussion about something called the new formalism, or even neo-formalism. As Pound wrote in the Pisan Cantos, to break the pentameter, that was the first heave. In the 80s and 90s, we were trying to break out of the 20th century, and some poets started writing again in meter and rhyme. And this formal poetry made some other poets really uptight. They felt really uptight about it. Formal poetry was criticized for being a decadently offensive luxury, as if it gilded the nipple. Formal poetry was even criticized for being a form of literary fascism. One writer in an essay called Neo-Formalism, A Dangerous Nostalgia, compared iambic pentameter to the goose step. As A.E. Stallings' poetry took root in print with its cosmic calibrated measures, its rhymes, sonic fibrillation, its high-speed races from origins to apogees, her poems left all those arguments in the dust. Instead of a shouting match between free poetry and formal poetry, we could start talking again about poetry. And I, too, want to read one of your poems. This is an early one, a postcard from Greece. Hatched from sleep. As we slipped out of orbit round a clothespin curve new watered with the rain, I saw the sea, the sky as bright as pain, that outer space through which we were to plummet. No guardrails hemmed the road, no way to stop it. The only warning, here and there, a shrine. Some tended still, some antique and forgotten, empty of oil, but all were consecrated to those who lost their wild race with the road and sliced the sea once like a knife. Somehow we struck an olive tree instead. Our car stopped on the cliff's brow. Suddenly safe, we clung together, shade to pagan shade, surprised by sunlight, air, this afterlife. So that's a Petrarchan sonnet, observing the rites of the form with masterful fervor, and the way in its imagery it's moving from orbit to clothespin, and so spanning such a speed, and while hitting the measures so beautifully. So it's set in Greece in a car, and we're scaling from the mundane safety of laundry out to orbit and the tedious sea. One last bit, A.E. Stallings, her name, who, I didn't know she was a she, you know? That's on purpose, and also an honor to A.E. Housman. So it's self burned away, like Eliot's filament of platinum. It's an extinction going on. And you get the sense that from the get-go, she's more interested in poetry than she is in poets. But I'm so glad that people found her to give her awards and stuff. And so please, please, let's really welcome her now.
Is it me? You might want to turn off my phone. All right. I'm going to grab some water. Yeah, okay.
Well, that was amazing and humbling. I'm so grateful to be here. This is our first trip to Ithaca, or any Ithaca, for that matter. it's humbling and also head-expanding to hear such things and to be on a T-shirt. And I'm so grateful to Shoka, to Dr. T, and to Gail, and to Cornell for bringing us here. We're grateful to Ithaca, who gave us the beautiful journey. And I thought I would talk, I'm going to speak about some things and read some poems. And what I wanted to talk about, it is true that for some reason, I write almost exclusively in received forms, whatever that may be. It does make some people mad. I think less so than it used to, but just it's unclear to me why. But it's not really meter that makes people mad. If you have an unrhymed poem that happens to be metrical, a lot of people just won't even realize it. That's not going to make them mad. What makes people upset is rhyme. Rhyme upsets people. So I was going to title this talk / reading, Rhyme and Unreason. 3.5 years ago, I remember this because I was pregnant with my daughter, I was commissioned to write a manifesto for Poetry Magazine. And I think Chris Wyman, the editor, and Don Scher, they decided they wanted to kind of stir things up, so they invited several poets from different schools or aesthetic leanings to write a manifesto. And at first, I wasn't really thrilled about this assignment. I'm not really big into manifestos. But then I sort of thought of a manifesto as a received form. I could write a manifesto as a received form. And so I thought, okay, I need something that's really subversive, something that gets people upset. And I thought, what better than to write about rhyme? So, I was commissioned to do this, and there's a certain element of me as a professional writer. If I'm commissioned and paid to do something, I will try to do it, give it my best shot. So this is my Presto Manifesto, a manifesto about rhyme. And I'm going to read this first and then talk a little bit about rhyme. The freedom to not rhyme must include the freedom to rhyme. Then verse will be free. All rhymed poetry must be rhyme-driven. This is no longer to be considered pejorative. Rhyme is at the wheel. No, rhyme is the engine. Rhyme is an engine of meter. Rhyme is an engine of syntax. Like meter, it understands the importance of prepositions. English is not rhyme poor. It is only uninflected. On the contrary, English has a richness in rhymes across different parts of speech, whereas in many other languages, rhyme is often merely a coincident jingle of accidents. There are no tired rhymes. There are no forbidden rhymes. Rhymes are not predictable unless lines are. Death and breath, womb and tomb, love and of, moon, June, spoon, all still have great poems ahead of them. I'm serious. Rhymes may be so far apart you cannot hear them, but they can hear each other as if whispering on a toy telephone made of two paper cups and a length of string. Rhymes do not need to be hidden or disguised. They are nothing to be ashamed of. Rhymes are not good Victorian children to be seen but not heard. Rhyme may be feminine or masculine, but not neuter. Some rhymes are diatonic, some are modal. Off rhymes founded on consonants are more literary than off rhymes founded on vowels. Vowels are shifty. Assonance is in the mouth, not the ear. It is performative. Consonance brings forth what is different, so we listen for what is the same. Assonance brings forth likeness. We listen for dissonance. The vowel is the third of the chord. Translators who translate poems that rhyme into poems that don't rhyme solely because they claim keeping the rhyme is impossible without doing violence to the poem have done violence to the poem. They are also lazy. Rhyme is an irrational, sensual link between two words. It is chemical. It is alchemical. April, silver, orange, month. Rhyme frees the poet from what he wants to say. Rhyme can also free a poem of fixed line length. A rhyme lets us hear the end of the line, so lines may be of any metrical length or even syllabic and still be heard. Rhyme schemes. Rhyme annoys people, but only people who write poetry that doesn't rhyme, and critics. See also chime, climb, crime, dime, grime, I'm, lime, mime, paradigm, pantomime, prime, rhyme, slime, sublime, time, time. Presto manifesto. It's true. Nobody wants to be called a new formalist. This is just one of those things. All kinds of people are clamoring at the door of the avant-garde. Please call me avant-garde, but nobody wants to be called a new formalist. It's sort of like being called a young fogey or something. Who only turn into old fogies. So it's one of these things that it's not necessarily a label that people like to have. But rhyme continues to be the thing that gets people upset. And that is because the issue of rhyme is an issue of control. If you look at all of the arguments for or against rhyme over the centuries, and it's the same argument over and over and over again, the argument against rhyme is that it hinders. It's a hindrance to free expression. And the argument for rhyme is that it unlocks secret associations. Rhyme is, it is a metaphor. If you define metaphor as the comparison of two dissimilar things wherein we find likenesses, that is what rhyme does. Rhyme has it's a sympathetic magic. Some people do not like that idea of the irrational in rhyme. So it is a kind of sympathetic magic where two things that have some kind of arbitrary similarity, in this case an end sound, also seem to have some other connection. Womb and tomb, gloom, doom, all seem to us to have some kind of fitted connectiveness. And of course, each language will have its own groupings. That's one of the language-specific things about rhyme that is difficult for the translator. But this sympathetic magic, for instance, breath and death, these would seem to be opposites. But instead, we listen to the fact that both of them end in this expiration of breath and death. And that's one of these very limited rhyme pairs. There's breath, death, Seth, Elizabeth. I guess now you have crystal meth. But breath and death will always, in English, have this magical connection. Rhyme has this effect of casting a spell, of giving a spell. And I use spell very literally. There has always been this connection in magic, too, with spellings, with the words themselves, the sounds of the words themselves. For instance, the word glamour, which came up, is one of my favorite words. Glamour, which I think we do think of in the sense of this sort of glimmering of celebrity, glamour is originally the Scots version of our word grammar. And again, it's this idea of casting a spell because of the power of words themselves. And rhyme has this. We expect witches to rhyme. Double trouble kind of things. But it's interesting that this controversy is almost as old as its usage. The classical poets, we think of Greek and Latin, did not rhyme. They knew about rhyme. Rhyme was actually more something that classical writers would use in the rhetoric of prose. It would perhaps punctuate the ends of periods and sentences and so forth. It was not really necessary for poetry in any way because you had these languages with all of these endings that repeated all the time. Rhymes were just all over the place. You couldn't, throw anything without hitting a rhyme. And that way, it was not able to have quite the same magical association it does once we've left those endings and become less inflected languages. After it became used in medieval Latin hymns, it gets brought over into the vulgar languages. And by vulgar, that is one of the things about rhyme. It's considered to be gross, barbarous, vulgar. It doesn't have the purity of the classical languages that don't rhyme. And so almost, you know, very early on, you get defenses and attacks on rhyme, and it's almost always the same arguments that come up. This is a defense of rhyme by Samuel David, 1603, who is responding to a treatise against the vulgarity, grossness, barbarousness of rhyme. Indeed, I have wished that there were not that multiplicity of rhymes as is used by many in sonnets, which yet we see in some so happily to succeed and hath been so far from hindering their inventions as it hath begot conceit beyond expectation and comparable to the best inventions of the world. For sure in an eminent spirit, whom nature hath fitted for that mystery, rhyme is no impediment to his conceit, but rather gives him wings to mount and carries him not out of his course, but as it were beyond his power to a far happier flight. So there's this idea that rhyme can take a poet out of himself. Take him, it's not about what the poet wants to say, but what the rhyme wants to say, that it can, you know, cause something surprising and inspired, this magical idea of inspiration. Samuel Daniel is maybe not one of the great, great, great poets, but a very fine poet. You might know his sonnet, Care, Charmer, Sleep, Son of the Sable Night, Brother to Death and Silent Darkness Born. One of the most famous attacks on rhyme in the English language is, of course, Milton, Before Paradise Lost, which he does in blank verse, which would be unrhymed iambic pentameter, which itself was an invention for the purpose of translation. The Earl of Sully invented it in order to translate the Aeneid of Virgil, which was not rhymed, and he thought it was important that the English not be rhymed. And of course, Milton was a perfectly good rhymer himself, but he didn't want that for Paradise Lost. The measure, he explains, is English heroic verse without rhyme, as that of Homer in Greek and of Virgil in Latin, rhyme being no necessary adjunct or true ornament of poem or good verse, in longer works especially, but the invention of a barbarous age to set off wretched matter and lame meter, graced indeed since by the use of some famous modern poets, carried away by custom, but much to their own vexation, hindrance, and constraint to express many things otherwise, and for the most part worse than else they would have expressed them. And it is it's not a good thing in itself to all judicious ears, trivial and of no true musical delight. So there is this idea that it's obvious that some people get pleasure out of rhymes, but it's somehow... it's a gross pleasure, it's a sensual pleasure, it's a bodily pleasure. It's not a mental, cerebral pleasure the way meter is. And it's these same arguments get knocked around again and again, that rhyme is a hindrance, it's a bondage. It bends the poet's thoughts out of shape. It is pleasurable, but it's the wrong kind of pleasure. This idea that bondage and pleasure can't go together. And where, in fact, the positive things are, again, that it's a sort of sympathetic magic. It is a rhetorical device in the sense that a rhetorical device is a way to persuade. And that is, again, what the argument against rhyme is that it's persuasive but illogical. It's like an advertising jingle. It somehow gets into your head by bypassing your higher thoughts. It is metaphor of the most radical and irrational kind. This is Rilke, pro-rhyme. Do not say anything against rhyme. It is a mighty goddess indeed, the deity of very secret and very ancient coincidences. And one must never let the fires on its altar burn out. She is extremely temperamental. One can neither anticipate nor invoke her. She arrives like happiness itself, her hands filled with blossoms of fulfillment. True rhyme is not a means of poetry, but an infinitely affirming yes that the gods impress like a seal on our most innocent emotions. So again, the argument for rhyme is an emotional and irrational one. Where you have, for instance, Nabokov on his prose translation of Onegin, he argues for why he doesn't think he should do a verse translation. Here are three conclusions I've arrived at. One, it is impossible to translate Onegin in rhyme. Two, It is possible to describe in a series of footnotes the modulations in rhyme of the text, etc. 3, it is possible to translate Onegin with reasonable accuracy by substituting, he gives his metrical things. These conclusions can be generalized. I want translations with copious footnotes, footnotes reaching up like skyscrapers to the top of this or that page, so as to leave only the gleam of one textual line between commentary and eternity. I want such footnotes and the absolutely literal sense, with no emasculation and no padding. Rhyme emasculates. I want such sense and such notes for all poetry in other tongues that still languishes in poetical versions, begrimed and beslimed by rhyme. Again, this is the infusion of rhyme into prose. And when my Onegin is ready, it will either conform exactly to my vision or not appear at all. On the other hand, he writes his apology for doing Onegin in prose in two perfect Pushkin sonnet stanzas. What is translation? On a platter, a poet's pale and glaring head, a parrot's screech, a monkey's chatter, and profanation of the dead. The parasites you were so hard on are pardoned if I have your pardon. Oh, Pushkin, for my stratagem, I traveled down your secret stem and reached the root and fed upon it. Then, in a language newly learned, I grew another stalk and turned your stanza patterned on a sonnet into my honest roadside prose, all thorn but cousin to your rose. He's showing off. He's saying, I could have done it. He has it both ways. And it ends, I analyze alliterations that grace your feasts and haunt the great fourth stanza of your canto 8. This is my task, a poet's patience and scholar and scholastic passion blent, dove droppings on your monument, begriming and besliming with rhyme. So I think it's perhaps worth understanding what happens when rhyme goes wrong, because this is what's always put forth about rhyme. It's always brought forth, well, look at this ghastly rhyme, as if all free verse could be condemned by bringing forth some ghastly free verse poems. And again, this idea of boring, tired, weary rhyme pairs comes up, for instance, in Pope's Essay on Criticism, very famous couple of couplets. This is about bad poets. While they ring round the same unvaried chimes with sure returns of still expected rhymes, wherever you find the cooling western breeze, and the next line, it whispers through the trees. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the readers threatened not in vain with sleep. Of course, Pope himself uses breeze and trees in other poems. And there are various reasons why these are bad rhymes and in this example. One of the things we think about, or maybe not consciously, but perhaps start to think about at a certain point, and even there are even words for this in other languages, like in Portuguese, rima, pobre, or whatever, is poor rhyme. And a poor rhyme is a rhyme on the same grammatical part of speech. So here we have, for instance, chimes and rhymes, two monosyllabic nouns. We have breeze and trees, two monosyllabic nouns. We have creep and sleep, two monosyllabic verbs. Why doesn't that work as well as, for instance, rhyming different parts of speech, rhyming different lengths of words, rhyming the abstract with the concrete? It's something to think about. One of these, the reasons, is that you want to both have a certain equivalence, but you also want to have energy. And those of you who are scientists will know much more about this than I, but I sometimes use the metaphor of a thermodynamic equilibrium, which sounds very nice, but it's death. I mean, it's when a system is dead. If you've got, two fronts that are the same temperature, nothing is going to happen. You need a cold front and a hot front. You need some kind of imbalance, some kind of asymmetry will give that coupled balance its energy. So, for instance, chimes, rhymes, breeze, trees, creep, sleep. Those aren't very exciting rhymes. You could still write a wonderful poem using those rhymes. But if you'll notice, what Pope is doing is he's showing you it's not just that the rhymes are poor, but the thought behind them is poor. It's not, While they ring around some unvaried chimes with sure returns of still expected rhymes, whenever you find the cooling western breeze, the entire phrase is a cliche. That is what makes the rhyme poor. The cooling western breeze, in the next line, it whispers through the trees. That whole phrase is a cliche. And a rhyme is just part of a phrase. Also, in English, where you have rhymes that are the same part of speech, that is probably because you're using rather boring syntax. If you have a poem that ends, you know, end rhymes, cat, mat, you know, rat, you're having sort of noun, verb, noun, noun, verb, noun. Where if you have something like a preposition, perhaps, before, if you have an adverb, if you have something that expands out, the syntax and the complexity of the thought in the poem is probably more complex. So even though he's mocking these rhyme pairs, it's not really the pairs themselves that are at fault. It's this whole lame, cliched phrases. You know, crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, and so on. And Frost was one of the first people to open my eyes to this. I mean, I had done some of it, I think, without thinking. You know, you realize that a poem was flat, and something about the rhymes was wrong. Even though there were perfect rhymes, there was something wrong about them. As Frost says in The Constant Symbol, the freshness of a poem belongs absolutely to its not having been thought out and then set to verse, as the verse in turn might be set to music. And then later, I may say the strain of rhyming is less since I came to see words as phrase ends to countless phrases, just as the syllables, ly, ing, ation, are word ends to countless words. There are countless phrases that might end in trees, and some of them will be amazing phrases, and some of them will be bored and boring and tired phrases. And also when he says, the freshness of a poem belongs absolutely to its not having been thought out and then set to verse, as the verse in turn is set to music, this is where criticizers, critics of rhyme, who don't write in rhyme themselves, misunderstand how rhyming poems work and how rhyming poets work. They do not think up what they want to say and then find rhymes for that thing, which might bend the saying thing out of shape. It is the rhymes that lead the poet to the discovery of what the poem is about. In this sense, I think of poets as bats. Poets are creatures who are blind, hanging upside down in a cave, and they have to let go into the unknown and find their way by calling out and listening to these resonances. For a rhyming poet, that is often the rhymes themselves telling the poem where it needs to go. This has been I've had wonderful reviews, I've had negative reviews, I've had wonderful, interesting negative reviews, I've been very lucky to have been reviewed at all, and I'm not complaining about being reviewed. But I'm just gonna give you a little example from a review of a misunderstanding of how a rhyming poet works, even though her criticisms may be quite valid, and she picks on a weak poem in the book Hapax. This was a review by Joan Houlihan, who's a critic I admire very much. I'm not criticizing her criticizing of me. I'm giving you an example. She says, reading A songs is like watching a thoroughbred horse win the race in spite of a weighted saddle. Magnificent horse, exciting race, but the handicap is a constant distraction, often becoming itself the focus. So she goes on, it is curious that Stallings seems wedded to end rhyming, mainly in true rhyme, no matter what the poem might otherwise do. You see, for me, the poem wouldn't exist otherwise. I could perhaps write a rhyming poem and then set it in free verse, but that would be a very bizarre proposition. Hapax provokes a question. What is the purpose of rhyme? Is it to emphasize meaning? Is it to bring pleasure to the ear? Is it to engage the reader at a physiological level? Certainly rhyme can do all of these things, but it doesn't need to be placed at the end of a line to do it, nor does it need to be true rhyme. To consistently seek out true rhymes and to constantly place them at the ends of lines has another purpose, the fulfillment of a prescribed pattern. This, you see, I would take issue with as a concept. This is not a purpose driven by the poem, but one driven by its maker. And for me, it's actually, that's backwards from how I feel that I work. I may be wrong. Frost also speaks quite a lot about performance, poetry as performance. And certainly there's an element in rhyme that is perhaps a little showy, perhaps a little putting it all out there. This is what I'm going to do, and if I do it badly, you're going to hear a big splat when I fall off the line. But I think he is also thinking of performance in its almost etymological sense, which is to fully furnish, to thoroughly fulfill. And in that sense of not fulfilling some idea that you have, but the rhyme fulfilling its own surprising expectations, one hopes. So I will read some poems, which may or may not have to do with... So you can think about this. Are these good rhymes? Are these bad rhymes? Or you could not think about the rhymes at all. That is fine, too. It seemed to me appropriate, since it was brought up that... I will say Archie Ammons, chose this poem. It was almost my first published non-juvenilia poem for Best American Poetry. And I was in a sort of crossroads, I think, in my work. I was trying very hard to get published, and I was writing poems I thought would get published instead of poems I really wanted to write or liked. And which I think is common with younger poets. And it was interesting, I sent a batch of poems to the Beloit Poetry Journal, and I threw this one at the last minute, and I thought they won't possibly take it because it's got rhyme in it. But that was the one they took. And I suddenly realized, you know, that people might like the rhyming poems, which is what I really enjoyed doing anyway. But you'll see here that this has just very occasional rhyme. Apollo takes charge of his muses. They sat there, nine women, much the same age, the same poppy red hair and similar complexions, freckling much the same in the summer glare, the same bright eyes of green melting to blue, melting to golden brown. They sat there, nine women, all of them very quiet. One perhaps was looking at her nails, one plaited her hair in narrow strands, one stared at a stone, one let fall a mangled flower from her hands, all nine of them very quiet. And the one who spoke said softly. This is a bit like maybe Bane taking over the muses. Of course, he was very charming, and he smiled, introduced himself, and said he'd heard good things. Shook hands all round, greeted us by name, assured us it would all be much the same, explained his policies, his few minor suggestions, which we would please observe. He looked forward to working with us. Wouldn't it be fun? Happy to answer any questions. Any questions? But none of us spoke or raised her hand, and questions there were none. What has poetry to do with reason or the sun? So this is another poem of kind of occasional internal rhyme, where I enjoyed putting the rhyme not at the end of the line, but at the beginning of the next stanza to sort of pull the poem along. And that was fun to do. I don't think I've done that since, but I enjoyed writing this poem. This is entitled, The Man Who Wouldn't Plant Willow Trees. Willows are messy trees. Hair in their eyes, they weep like women after too much wine and not enough love. They litter a lawn with leaves like the butts of regrets smoked down to the filter. They are always out of kilter. Thirsty as drunks, they'll sink into a sewer with their roots. They have no pride. There's never enough sorrow. A breeze threatens, and they shake with sobs. Willows are slobs and must be cleaned up after. They'll bust up pipes just looking for a drink. Their fingers tremble but make wicked switches. They claim they are sorry, but they whisper it. I guess those are those whispering trees, but I didn't rhyme it with breeze, so. Not this time, anyway. I'm sure I've done it. So, and one of the nice things about rhyme, too, you can use rhyme in what is essentially a prose poem. You don't necessarily have to have rhyme in a metrical poem. One of the Greek myths that has long fascinated me and many other people, obviously, is the myth of Hades and Persephone and Demeter, or Proserpina. Well, I just think it has this universal appeal. It's creepy. There's this creepy god of the dead who takes off the sort of Little Red Riding Hood character down to the underworld, and you've got the angry mother and so on. And I've written several poems about this, and I thought I'd kind of got it out of my system, but evidently I haven't. And this is also a received form, but not one that's usually used for poetry, but it suddenly occurred to me that I could use it for a poem. And reading it in an academic environment is very appropriate. It is called First Love, a Quiz. He came up to me, A, in his souped-up Camaro, B, to talk to my skinny best friend, C, and bumped my glass of wine so I wore the fairest stain on my sleeve, D, from the ground in a lead chariot drawn by a team of stallions black as crude oil and breathing sulfur. At his heart, he sported a tiny golden arrow. Some of you will hear the arrow Camaro thing. He offered me A, a ride, B, dinner and a movie with a wink at the cliche, C, an excuse not to go back alone to the apartment with its sink of dirty knives, D, a narcissus with 100 dazzling petals that breathed a sweetness as cloying as decay. I went with him because A, even his friends told me to beware, B, I had nothing to lose except my virginity, C, he placed his hand in the small of my back and I felt the tread of honeybees, D, he was my uncle, the one who lived in the half-finished basement, and he took me by the hair. The place he took me to, A, was dark as my shut eyes, B, and where I ate bitter seed and became ripe, C, and from which my mother would never take me wholly back, though she wept and walked the earth and made the bearded ears of barley wither on their stalks and the blasted flowers drop from their sepals. D is called by some men hell and others love. E, all of the above. Love above, that's a good one. Good old one. One of the things, living a lot of my life in another language in which I am not a native speaker, is there's certain things that the poems are almost have phrases that are themselves translations. It's as if I'm writing a poem in translation sometimes. This is from a series called, I'm not a big writer of sequences. I admire people who can do it, but I usually write two. That's not really a sequence. So it occurred to me that what you could do is just gather a bunch of little poems and give them an overarching grand title. So this has the overarching title, Exile Picture Postcards. It's very grand. But it's several little sonnety type things. So this is a poem called Buzuki, which Gail could tell a lot more about than I. But Buzuki is an instrument from Asia Minor that is very typical of Greek folk music and of sort of Greek blues, this music that is all about suffering and misery and is very cathartic and wonderful. So this is called Buzuki. After 5 years here, I understand most of the sung words recognize the tune. But there's an element I'll never get that isn't born in me. The way they play, one manages to hold his cigarette between two fingers on his strumming hand, takes drags between his solos, and then soon how something changes. A woman starts to sway around an absent center, ancient wrongs cherished. The cigarette gives up its ghost. The music drives now. Someone makes a toast as suddenly the melody arrives at minor, Asia Minor, in whose songs the hands of lovers always rhyme with knives. Which is it's sort of a double joke for me because Greek, it's tacheria and macheria. They do rhyme, and it's one of those pairings, whereas, you know, we don't have that hands are knives thing, but Greek had, that's one of their sort of sacred and mysterious pairings. Let's see. So this is my bat metaphor. explaining an affinity for bats, that they are only glimpsed in silhouette and seem something else at first, a swallow, and move like new tunes, difficult to follow, staggering towards an obstacle they yet avoid in a last-minute pirouette, somehow telling solid things from hollow, sounding out how high a space or shallow, revising into deepening violet, that they sing, not the way the songbird sings, whose song is rote to ornament finesse, but travel by a sort of song that rings true not in utterance, but hearkenings, who find their way by calling into darkness to hear their voice bounce off the shape of things. I think the idea that rhyme somehow hinders the poet from what he or she wants to say, that it somehow prescribes and tells you what to do and bosses you around. There's a sort of game that I think was started in the 1800s called bout rime, where you are given the end words of a sonnet and you have to come up with a new sonnet. And again, I was sort of invited to give this a shot. And these rhymes were taken from Shakespeare's Sonnet 20, which is a very gender-switching around poem. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted, hast thou the master mistress of my passion? A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting changes, is false woman's fashion. So this is very gender-bending, cross-dressing sonnet, all in interestingly feminine rhymes. And those are painted passion, acquainted fashion, rolling gazeth, controlling amazeth, created a doting, defeated nothing, pleasure, treasure. And we were asked to write a sonnet to these, and I said, no, I cannot do it, absolutely not, cannot do it. And we were allowed to cheat a little bit. We were allowed to say gazes instead of gazeth, and amazes instead of amazeth, so that was nice. But and a lot of the sonnets, when they did come out in this journal, were again about gender-bending, cross-dressing, sexual sorts of things. And I think once I just decided I'm just going to put away Shakespeare 20 altogether from my mind and just look at these things, it was a point where, the title is On the Nearest Pass of Mars in 60,000 Years. And this was something I was thinking about and wanted to write a poem about. And suddenly the poem came to me in these rhymes. So this is another thing of the rhyme not telling me what to say or bossing me around, but helping me to discover a way to write a poem about something I was interested in writing about. War or strife? Yes, you were always painted in carnadine, hematic, flushed with passion, sanguine. We depicted you acquainted with ruby hues, the rage in mortal fashion. And yet to see you ever closer, rolling elliptical through emptiness, our gazes are met now with a gaze past our controlling, red as an eyeball through which blood amazes and stony blind. Although we have created gods and goddesses of loathing, doting, they neither love nor hate us, are defeated by telescopes that taper into nothing, a stare reflecting on itself, a pleasure cold and ferric, nothing we can treasure. So that's an interesting experiment, maybe not my greatest poem or anything, but there it is. One of the things rhyme does is it's interesting to work with rhyme with syllabics. So not metrical lines, but lines that are governed by the number of syllables, because it helps you hear the end of the line. It gives the line a little bit of integrity to it, and it's fun. But anyway, this is a very recently invented form called a fib, which is based on the Fibonacci numbers. So you'll remember 0, 1, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 2, 1 plus 2 is 3, 2 plus 3 is 5, 3 plus 5 is 8, 8 plus 5, 13. Okay, so I thought it would be fun to try this. And so I guess technically the first line is silence. And since they're called fibs, I thought it'd be fun to write about lies. So this is called Four Fibs. Did Eve believe or grapple over the apple? Eavesdropping Adam heard her say to the snake oil salesman she was not born yesterday. miss. This is not bliss. A timer. I am rounding up. But how do I stop? Slide stop timer. Miss, this is not bliss. Wisdom is not the abyss, but visceral innocence. Kiss the windfall of the world, she heard him whisper or hiss. Not me, not me, cried all three. You shall creep the earth, and you shall labor giving birth, and as for you, you shall toil and sweat for all your worth. Cross your heart and hope to die. Stick a needle in your eye. That is the awful oath of childhood, chapter and verse, genesis of the lie. So I'll read just maybe two more, and then we can talk and have some questions. This is a poem where I stole one of the lines. It's a triolet or triolet, which is only 8 lines to begin with. It was the first poem I wrote as a new mother with a colicky baby, and I was walking up and down the floor, this screaming infant who was obviously not at all grateful to have been brought into the world. And the line just kept going through my head, and it's not my line. And then this whole triolet came forth out of it. And again, I don't think the rhymes themselves maybe don't look that exciting. Tunes, night, spoons, spite, afternoons. The most interesting is afternoons, but that is also in the critical position in the poem. Triolet on a line apocryphally ascribed to Martin Luther. It's okay to steal if you put that up front. Why should the devil get all the good tunes, the booze and the neon and Saturday night, the swaying in darkness, the lovers like spoons? Why should the devil get all the good tunes? Does he hum them to while away sad afternoons and the long, lonesome Sundays, or sing them for spite? Why should the devil get all the good tunes, the booze and the neon and Saturday night? And I will end on this poem. So a good thing to do after you've had a big argument with your spouse is to dedicate a long poem about it to him. Now this poem, I stole the rhyme scheme for the poem, and it's the rhyme scheme of Cavafi's The City, which is a fascinating rhyme scheme to me because it's an 8-line stanza. I don't steal the metrical pattern, just the rhyme pattern. It's an 8-line stanza, so it goes A, B, B, C, C, D, D, A. And it's all about not being able to go somewhere, not being able to leave, and it's so wonderful that when you start reading the poem, you think these couplets are going somewhere, and they don't. They come back to that A. So. Since this was also about leaving a city, I thought it would be fun to try this rhyme scheme. And it is called On Visiting a Borrowed Country House in Arcadia for John. To leave the city always takes a quarrel. Without warning, rancors that have gathered half the morning, like things to pack or a migraine or a cloud, are suddenly allowed to strike. They strike the same place twice. We start by straining to be nice, then say something shitty. Isn't it funny how it's what has to happen to make the unseen ivory gate swing open, the rite we must perform so we can leave? Always we must grieve our botched happiness. We goad each other till we pull to the hard shoulder of the road, yielding to tears inadequate as money. But if instead of turning back, we drive into the day, we forget the things we didn't say. The silence fills with row on row of vines or olive trees. The radio hums to itself. We make our way between Saronic blue and hills of glaucous green and thread beyond the legend of the map through footnote towns along the coast that boast ruins of no account, a column more woebegone than solemn, men watching soccer at the two cafes and half-built lots where dingy sheep still graze. Climbing into the lap of the mountains now, we wind around blind centrifugal turns. The sun's great warship sinks and burns, and where the roads without a sign are crossed, we inevitably get lost. Yet to be lost here still feels like being somewhere. And we find when we arrive and park, no one minds that we are late. There is no one to wait, only a bed to make, a suitcase to unpack. The earth has turned her back on one yellow middling star to consider lights more various and far. The shaggy mountains hulk into the dark or loom like slow titanic waves. The cries of owls dilate the shadows. Weird harmonics rise from the valley's distant glow, where coal extracted from the lignite mines must roll on acres of conveyor belts that sing the Pythagorean music of a string. A huge gray plume of smoke or steam towers like the ghost of a monstrous flame or giant tree among the trees, and it is all the same. The power plant, the forest, and the night, the man-made light. We are engulfed in an immense, ancient indifference that does not sleep or dream. Call it nature, if you will. Though everything that is natural, the lignite bearing earth, the factory, a darkness taller than the sky, this out of doors that wins us our release and temporary peace, not because it is pristine or pretty, but because it has no pity or self-pity.
I'm instructed to see if there are questions, and if A.E. Stallings will take them. Are you? Is that okay?
I'll try.
Try. Is that something people would like to do? Yes, it seems. So I'm going to let you take them because of the.
Okay. Yes.
Your poems are also very playful and very musical. So when you read your Persephone poem with the multiple choice, I was expecting, or did it ever? Grapple with instead of saying D, all of the above, because we're dealing with Hades, saying D, all of the below.
I wish I thought of that. I might steal that. Later. Damn. Yes?
I have a question about a line from your manifesto. You said translation must keep rhyme.
No. Allow me to reread. Translators who translate poems that rhyme into poems that don't rhyme solely because they claim keeping the rhyme is impossible, that doing violence to the poem, have done violence to the poem. I don't say it can't be done, just that should not be the only excuse.
Okay. I'm sorry. my question, though, was in reference to something that Nicanor Parra said about translation. He said there is no such thing as translation, just rewriting. And I was wondering what you thought about that statement in connection to translation rhyme.
Well, I mean, it's true in a sense. I mean, translating is the most frustrating, thankless task in the world. And that is a case where you know what you want to say, you have to find a way to say it. You're not really. But there are various kinds of equivalences. I mean, you want to give a sense. I mean, Penguin Classics for a long time, for instance, would translate various epics and so forth into, you know, solid, clear, readable prose translations, which is wonderful. You get the gist. But if part of the gist of the poem is really that it is a poem, you could have completely missed that. It is rewriting. And translating, I think of also, and I'm going to talk about this at the translation talk in greater detail. Translation is also metaphor. I mean, translation is to carry across. Metaphor is to carry across. And it's a sort of border crossing. There's a customs, and there's some things you're not allowed to take across, and there's some things that you can take across, and there's some things you can smuggle across. But there are border guards, and you're not going to be able to take everything exactly the same. If that answers.
Are there any forms, received forms that you've written in that you decided that you will just never write them again? I mean, I know people who have said, that's it, that's my last Sistina, never, never, never again.
Sistina, yeah. there are enough of those. Now I'll probably write one, but in fact I've only written a really, it barely even counts as a Sistina. Some of the lines are like one word. I now have theories about the Sistina because I've taught them several times that the problem with the Sistina is not repeated words. I mean, repeated words are not a problem. Any kind of narrative, three bears or whatever, you're going to have bears, you're going to have Goldilocks, you're going to have just right, you know. It writes itself. The problem with the Sistina is it's 39 lines, which is a long poem for a lyric poem. And people start off and they get into trouble always. It's always the same place, around like line 20 or something, because they've run out of things to say in the Sistina. So you have to have enough to say to write a Sistina. That's my new Sistina theory.
Yes?
Thank you for a wonderful talk. I want to ask you about the arbitrary in rhyme. Doing something just for the rhyme. In a way, your whole talk has been in a way to say there's no such thing as doing something just for the rhyme. To do it for the rhyme is to do it for the poem, which is always smarter than the poet.
One hopes.
Not always. When you quoted lovely Rilke saying that the rhyme can arrive, or the rhyme sort of arrives for the poet in that odd, you know, what Nicholson Baker calls the vestibule, right before you, the to-be-typed vestibule, it arrives like happiness itself, right? And happiness is luck, the luck of happiness. In a way, I mean, you're suggesting, or the question is, you suggest almost that there's an argument about how to live ethically in writing rhyming poetry, how to live happily, how to live with the good luck that language bestows on all of us.
I think my argument is going to kind of, with the translation talk, I'm largely going to be talking about Lucretius and Epicurus, and there is a certain... the happy, lucky randomness of rhyme and the pleasure of it, which is, of course, a totally Epicurean principle, that pleasure is the highest good. And the arguments, I'm not sure that the arguments for rhyme are, well, I think there is a certain ethical element in the arguments against rhyme are against its arbitrariness, its irrationality, and its pleasure. And they tend to be fairly consistent in those are the problems with it. As opposed to seeing that as a kind of weird, I personally think of writing in form as not about my trying to control the poem, but about my giving up control over certain things and allowing other things to happen. And now, there you can rhyme badly, as you can do free verse badly, and some of that is, you know, you don't always take the first rhyme that pops its head up. You know, so you think a little bit, you open up. But for instance, in that poem about visiting the house in Arcadia, I think I would not have put shitty in the poem, but I had city. And somehow, that gave me permission to put shitty in the same poem as Pythagorean. And so that was a happy surprise for me. That's, you know, that happened.
Yes.
I wonder if you could talk a little about the demonic, value of rhyme.
Well, certainly one of the powerful things about rhyme is it does help you remember. And mnemonic, of course, is from the goddess Mnemosyne, who is memory and is the mother of all the muses. And rhyme certainly helps for that. It's part of the pleasure of it. I do think it actually, a rhymed poem is laid down in the brain differently from an unrhymed poem, that there are certain connections, you know, literally neurological connections that are made because of those rhymed sounds. And it's easier to memorize a rhyming poem. Whether that is necessarily a good or bad thing, I don't know. But it's certainly one of the pleasures that when you memorize a poem, that it literally becomes part of your brain. It is literally part of you, and you carry it with you wherever you go. I mean, when I was in labor with my two children, I would play poems. You know, there were poems that I didn't always get to the end of them, but that was part of the furniture of my brain that I had access to. Even if I had access to nothing else, I had these wonderful poems.
I was very interested to hear this very positive account of rhyme as a form of navigating language. And some of the ways that you're describing it, especially the bat, I was thinking about how, well, this is, you're able to make sense of a space in language. But also I was hearing a kind of negativity, the blindness of the bat. And I guess I kept thinking about death, breath, and crystal meth, and which rhymes are closer or farther away from each other, right? And I was wondering, when you're navigating, say, breath, death, and crystal meth, what is the experience for you of trying to avoid something? So in the negative feeling of having an aversion to a kind of rhyme, could you talk about that?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, rhyme is very similar to humor or telling a joke in the sense that it sets up an expectation. And that's part of the performance of rhyme. It sets up an expectation. It sort of sets a contract. This is what I'm going to do. And then you have various options. You can give the cliched obvious rhyme. You can subvert that expectation. You can not rhyme. You could off rhyme at the very end of a poem and give someone, you know, throw someone the way, like you're walking upstairs and you think there's one more stair and there's not. It sets up an expectation that you can play off. And I think that there is an idea, if you are working in rhymed poems and you feel that it's not having this magical property for you, you don't always have to take the first rhyme that comes along. In fact, it's really interesting to work in things that are not rhymed pairs. I've recently been doing a lot of things in Atava Rima where I'm having to come up with three rhymes. And I'm so used to coming up with two rhymes that, like, coming up with three rhymes is challenging, but it's often the third rhyme that's the most interesting one and takes the poem in an interesting place. You know, and when you're revising, that it's wonderful to revise in form, because sometimes something is a prop. You know, sometimes I know I need a rhyme for this. This isn't the right rhyme. I'm going to stick it in there, get through the poem, and I'm going to obsess about this for the next 5 years. And then one day it'll you know, pop into my head. So I think the idea that you don't have to take the first thing that is handed to you out of habit, you can explore, because often the further you go, the more interesting it gets.
So please join me in thanking her for a wonderful, wonderful...